Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, we discuss the Newton, Connecticut school shootings, mental illness, and gun control. Some might say we've had this conversation before because there have been so many mass shootings in our country. This year alone, there have been 16. Those making headlines: in July, the shooting at a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado. 12 were killed, 58 injured. On August 5th, the shooting at a Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. 6 killed, 3 injured. December 11th, the shooting at a shopping mall in Happy Valley, Oregon. 2 killed, 1 injured. And then, this past Friday, the shooting at the elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut. 26 killed, 20 of them children. We are opening our phone lines and want you to join in the conversation with your thoughts, your questions. And we begin with a local response. Our phone lines that are open, you can call us at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989 or online at the all-new KVPR.org. Again, we will begin with our local response. Joining us is Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims. Also, Fresno County Superintendent of School Michael Hansen will be joining us later. We begin with Sheriff Mims. Good morning, Sheriff Mims, and thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Good morning, Juanita.
Let's begin. You know, you are in law enforcement. You've been through a lot, but, you know, when you heard the news about the shootings in Newtown, what was your immediate response?
Well, my immediate response was children were involved, and just heartbreaking that somebody decided to target young children. And then, of course, I thought about the first responders. Every time there's an incident like this, we all try and take a look at the incident, look at the response, and see what we can learn from the experience. We did the same thing, for instance, with our Minkler shooting in which a deputy sheriff was shot and killed. How that happens, communication goes, how logistics goes, we take a look at that, and we all learn from what happens in these incidents. And I feel bad not only for the families, Juanita, but also for the first responders to have to see what they saw that day and then deliver the message to the families. There's going to be a lot of ongoing issues, psychological issues with everybody involved.
You know, here in this valley, we haven't had a tragedy like this, but your officers have also dealt with scenes of unspeakable tragedy. And I know you touched on that a little bit, but you know, what are the law enforcement officials in Newtown going through right now?
Well, I'm sure that this particular crime scene, and that's exactly what it is, a crime scene, is something like they've never seen before in most of their careers. To see very young children, ages 6 and 7, shot to death, and from the news reports, some of them multiple times. They are going to relate their own families and their own children to what they see. A deputy sheriff, when I went to calls that dealt with young children, I always personalized that and thought about my own children. I couldn't get to them fast enough. I couldn't talk to them on the phone quick enough. The first thing I wanted to do was grab them and hug them, tell them how much I love them. And I'm sure that's what the first responders in Newtown are going through right now.
You know, we've had a string, and we've mentioned some of them at the top of this report. We've had a string of these kind of tragedies. I mean, people are asking, what is going on? What is going on? What do you think? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think these are people, many of them, who just have an evil plan. I know that you mentioned mental health at the top of your program. And I don't think autism, from what the reports are saying, that this suspect in this case had autism, but that's not a mental illness. So I'm waiting to hear what the final reports are. Was there mental illness in addition to the autism? Autism does not make you violent or go out and shoot children. I'm really interested in knowing, you know, what was, if we ever find out, Juanita, what caused him to make the decision to not just kill his mother, which is horrible enough, but then to go to an elementary school and kill little children.
We are going to have, that's going to be part of our discussion today, is the whole issue with the mental health. As you know, we're struggling with it here in the Central Valley. It's been an ongoing problem as far as services are concerned. I would also like to bring in Superintendent Michael Hansen now with Fresno Unified. Superintendent Hansen, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
Part of what we have talked about, I asked Sheriff Mims this question, and being a superintendent of one of the larger school districts in the state, and being in charge of so many students, when you first heard that news, what was that like for you?
I probably was, like most people in America, absolutely stunned, and still to this day have great difficulty completely comprehending the magnitude of what went on, and simply don't want to think about the details of all of it. But I think, like our president and others who have spoken publicly, beyond my position as superintendent of schools, I continually fall back to my position as father first, and just find myself struggling to comprehend the enormity of it.
You know, when the Columbine shooting happened at the high school there, I remember so many people feeling the same way about how could this happen? How could something like this happen? After all, young people were targeted. Children were targeted. And here we are, you know, years later, still going through something like this. And I know, you know, schools learned a lot from Columbine, and Fresno Unified probably, I don't know about your other campuses, but I know you've had police on campus in your high schools for quite some time. How did that change as far as what you all do when it comes to safety?
Well, I will answer that in just a minute, but I'd like to go back to as I joined the call to where Sheriff Mims was earlier around the quick discussion of autism and the autism spectrum. Just to be really clear, we want to make certain that we don't start to blend terms in conversations like this, because a student or a young adult or an adult on the autism spectrum, someone who has a disability, for example, in that world doesn't equate to mental illness. And when we talk about mental illness, I think people, we're talking about a definitively different behavioral set than someone who, for example, would be covered in our school system under the Individual Disability Act, and they're covered with an IEP, an Individual Education Plan, and they're a part of our special education program. So we need to be very careful about how we talk about this. And I think that the sheriff would probably agree the type of folks that we're talking about being very careful to watch, monitor, and bring forward is folks in our community, students, adults who make threats, students who we see dramatic changes in their behavior patterns that might be precursors to something leading to horrific behavior like this. Those are the folks that almost always, every one of these cases I've seen, there seems to be something in the background or in the past that should have been called out or could have been called out and was missed.
But, you know,
so that when I talk about the a mental illness, as I've made some comments in the press, I want people to recognize what we're really talking about is you know, people who are demonstrating some changes in behaviors and are saying and doing things that are out of the norm from even their normal behavior patterns that people have known.
You're right about that. Oftentimes after these incidents, There have been warning signs. They may not surface right at the beginning, but that's even something we're beginning to see as they continue to investigate the case in Newtown. But the bottom line is many of these young people are still in the schools. They're right. They're going to school with everybody else. And so it is difficult. And how do you know? You know, and I know it's hard for teachers in school because you are charged with educating students, all students.
Right. So I would go back to your question, Juanita, about security procedures. So we have in our district a plan that we have adopted by our board and has been put in place by all of our principals and is reviewed repeatedly across our campuses every year, that is aligned with the state emergency management system and the national emergency management standards around how we lock our schools down, how we evacuate our schools. Much of the procedures that have been outlined in the news of late are in place in our schools. We frankly dramatically changed how we deal with, and police in particular changed their practices post-Columbine with how they deal with someone on a campus with a weapon, for example. But as we saw in Newtown, they had a security system in place that far exceeds probably most schools in the nation, with a locked campus and having to show video ID to be buzzed in even into the building. And that didn't stop someone who was, frankly, hell-bent on getting in. They just, stormed their way in with weapons. So it's a very uneasy feeling that we have at a time like this, that even when we have armed school resource officers on our high school campuses, we have the safety plans and we have training and we have campus assistance, we have cameras on our campuses, we have a system that we can notify families if something's gone on, but none of that can prevent, in each and every case, something like Newtown or a similar case in every instance. It just, there is actually no way. It's why we have law enforcement as an institution. There's no way for us ever to design a system that will withstand the creativity of and the brute force of the criminal mind when they're set on trying to be destructive.
You know, Sheriff Mims, I think in the past, maybe still now, you have been a supporter of concealed carry permits for qualified individuals. Now, do you think that makes our community safer as a whole, or basically are we just arming a lot of people?
Well, Juanita, out of all of the incidents that you mentioned at the beginning of the show, I don't believe any of them was caused by somebody who carried a concealed weapons permit. I have literally a zero problems with people that qualify for a concealed weapons permit. Those that are committing these crimes are not permit holders. And so just the background that you go through to get a permit requires a pretty good level of being a responsible citizen.
Well, you know, in a lot of these incidents, these people acquired the guns legally.
Sure, but that's different than having a concealed weapons permit. In California, you can own a legal weapon in your home or business with no permit.
That's true. You know, Senator Feinstein is calling for lawmakers to reinstate the federal assault weapons ban, which was in effect from 1994 till it expired in 2004. Was that ban, when it was in effect, was it effective?
Well, we had killings even back then. Anybody who wants to get a semi-automatic weapon, and that's what this weapon sounds like it was, if they're bent on illegal activity, can get one of these weapons illegally. They just can. That's where we have the problem, where criminals are armed, not law-abiding citizens. So that's the worry that I have.
How often do you see these assault weapons, the semi-automatic weapons, showing up in crimes here in Fresno County?
With gang members, they get those weapons and they show up often. Most of the weapons, however, that we see are handguns.
Either way, there are an awful lot of shootings. Superintendent Hansen, you talked about what Fresno Unified has done. You all have a very effective crisis management team. How do you train the teachers to deal with violence in the classroom?
Right. The question, I just want to point out, the crisis management team is very effective, and sadly, we're effective, not just because we're always training, but because in the city of Fresno, we have so many crises that occur in our community. So things that happen not just on and around our campuses, the vast majority happen off campus, out in the community after hours. But our students bring that emotion and that pain and anger and all the rest to campuses. So our crisis team, frankly, is quite practiced. They don't do drills. They are in action repeatedly because of the violence in our community and the crisis that continue to occur, you know, on an almost weekly, well, I would say weekly basis. And that's not to be understated. So let me go back to the question then. So it's great that we have such talented individuals who can help in times of crises. I don't think it's altogether great that they have such a high skill level born out of repetition and they're so practiced because it occurs so much in our community. I think that's two different ways to look at the team. But with respect to in the classroom, you know, we have training that we've given our teachers and continue to offer around classroom management and how we operate with students. But frankly, not all of that is always going to work given what happens in a community and what a child may bring into a classroom each and every day.
That's tough.
So our teachers are caught sometimes on a Tuesday morning with a very different classroom full of kids walking in based on what happened Monday night, and even some of their best classroom management techniques can't actually mitigate the flat-out anger and rage that students may have based on what they witnessed or what was inflicted upon them the night before. And so they can't always manage it right in a classroom, and that's where we have to have our safe and civil schools training kick in, and we have to have our vice principals and our principals and our school psychologists and some of the crisis teams help to support as well. It's a very fluid process. We would love to be able to say that our teachers are trained in the position in classrooms to handle everything that walks through the door, but the fact of the matter is what happens in communities is far and away sometimes too great for them to manage because their primary job is to teach kids. And sometimes what walks through the door is just too great for them to deal with. So it's a very fluid situation, and it's almost dealt with. I mean, this doesn't sound like a clean answer, but it is very fluid, and it depends classroom to classroom, day to day, based on what walks through the door. But our teachers are continually trying to upgrade their skills and abilities to capture and keep kids in class and keep them focused as best they can. But trauma is trauma. And it is difficult to keep kids always focused based on what they've just experienced.
I would like to have both of your thoughts on this. You know, there have been some people out there even advocating or saying that teachers should be armed. Is that a realistic option, or are we just kind of adding to the problem?
Well, for me, absolutely not, right? More guns on a campus. I'm very comfortable with a school resource officer as an armed law enforcement agent on campus, and everybody knows it. But anything beyond that, for me, we cease to be a school, in my mind. We need to be a learning institution, and we need to work to create and maintain safe learning environments. And that, in my mind, doesn't include having teachers be armed.
Sheriff Mims?
Yes, and that would be my preference, to have trained armed law enforcement on the campuses. You know, there used to be a federal grant program that put law enforcement on school campuses. There was federal funding for that. And I believe that was very important. The kids could interact with law enforcement. We could get information about crimes going on in the neighborhood. We were able to be preemptive on crimes that occurred. If there was a burglary, for instance, that we would assign it to that officer assigned to the school. And that grant program went away, and so we didn't have enough deputy sheriffs to keep them in the schools. So my preference would be also to have positive relationship with the schools by having law enforcement on the campuses. And Juanita, I have to add that we have a great relationship with the school districts in Fresno County, and not just with Superintendent Hansen, but with Superintendent Powell with the county schools. We work very closely with them, and anything we can do to be of service with them, we certainly want to be great partners.
Yes, we've seen that you both really have. I know you both have to go at this point. We want to thank both of you. We could spend so much more time on this, and maybe we can when we take a look at talking about some kind of solutions. I mean, it's far-reaching, having to do with so many other issues, but I thank you both for sharing your thoughts and giving your time this morning.
Thank you, Juanita.
I am Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson. We will continue our discussion following the mass shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. We are still learning about 20-year-old Adam Lanza, the shooter in the Newtown school shootings. We do know he did have a mental illness. It's still not clear exactly what he was diagnosed with. But unfortunately, a number of those involved in these kinds of mass killings suffered from some form of mental illness. But as you heard Superintendent Hansen speak to before, we have to be careful about what we describe as a mental illness. So here to continue our conversation on the shootings and mental illness and gun control are Mary Lou Brownte Minkler, Board President, National Alliance of Mental Illness, Fresno. We also have Brian Gibb, Director of Public Education, National Council for Community Behavioral Healthcare, and Professor Kyle Weir, Associate Professor of Marriage and Family Therapy at Fresno State. Before we get into some of the other questions about mental health, we know, Professor Ware, that a lot of people are going through anxiety over this last shooting. We've mentioned we've had these kind of things before, but this one really seems to has just maybe been the last straw for a lot of people. How is this impacting families, children?
Oh, it's significantly impacting families. From people, I know of people who simply went Friday and picked up their kids and held them and hugged them. Lots of anxiety. Children are asking questions about what happened, and parents are struggling with how to even talk to their kids about this and what to tell them and what not to tell them. And at Fresno Family Counseling Center, where we see families a lot, we're just seeing a lot of concern and anxiety about.
Are parents getting that from their children? Are their children coming to them asking questions?
Yes, because they hear about it at school. They, in this day of technology, children, get news probably about as fast as the adults do. And they hear of the things, and so they ask questions. I mean, I had my own kindergartner on Friday talking to me, asking me what went on, Dad. And
I mean, that's when you imagine these kids were 5 and 6.
Yeah.
You think about a 5 and 6-year-old.
Yeah.
And the kind of discussions you have with the 5 and 6-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And having to differentiate between, make-believe and real and what we know and what we don't know yet. And those are complex things for little children to try to understand.
As we mentioned about this portion of our discussion, talking about mental illness, Where are we in this country when it comes to mental health care? I do know there have been a lot of budget cuts, but is it something that we are really putting the resources in that we should? I'll start with you, Mary Lou, and then Mr. Gibb.
Well, it seems as though in the last years, especially with budget cuts during this recession, often in a community, some of the first cuts are in mental health care and treatment, and people don't regard that as a crucial service to provide for others. So the mental health care across the country has gone through dramatic changes in this last decade.
Mr. Gibb, she touched on something in that oftentimes, really, mental health care seems to be the first to go. People seem to not understand how important it is.
Well, and thank you, Juanita, for inviting me on the show. I have to say that certainly we live in a country of limited resources, and so there's not a psychiatrist or a counselor on every street corner. That said, there are resources, especially there in the Fresno area, that people can reach out to. That there is some federal parity legislation that has helped over the past couple of years, but I'm certainly not saying that it's not difficult to get mental health care, but it is out there, I think, if people seek it out. Many of your listeners, I'm sure, have EAP, employee assistance programs, through their jobs. That's one way that they can reach out and they can get some resources. There in the Fresno area, there's organizations like Kingsview Behavioral Health System, which on some level can support individuals who may not have EAP programs or EAP access to insurance. And then, of course, there's the county, Fresno, Madera, Tulare, Visalia, et cetera. So there are resources, but you're right. There is a limit to, and not always a bed for everyone who wants one.
And that was one of the things mentioned. And I've talked to many parents who have tried to find resources, especially in-bed facilities or other long-term care. They're forced to leave the area when it comes to that kind of care. And it often seems like these parents are kind of sort of left to fend and deal with this on their own.
Well, certainly in many cases with young people who have severe mental illness, you're right. Not every community has those resources, and sometimes there are waiting lists. One of the things that we've been doing at the National Council for Community Behavioral Health Care is we have a public education program called Mental Health First Aid. And this education program is designed to train the general public how to recognize what some of the signs and symptoms are of someone having a mental health problem, and ideally to get them help early. Because the research shows that the sooner that someone can get help, the more likely they are to have a positive outcome. So our goal is in prevention also, prevention of crisis, to try to get someone some help when they're experiencing a lower intensity problem rather than later on when maybe their illness has progressed to become more complex.
And we've often heard, too, that in many of these cases, people thought that they saw something different in a young person. You hear it now, but many of them, they don't know what to do. And I know, Professor, where you wanted to jump in on this.
Well, I was just going to say that as Mr. Gibb said, that the early intervention is the key. And one of the things that we see as we look at budget allocations and cost issues is, the offset cost. If we can provide the care early on, say we see a teenager with depression, or if we can early on catch that, it's far cheaper to do that than to deal with, later on when they're, needing hospitalization or other kinds of things. So that if we provide the resources early on and focus on prevention and early intervention, it's actually much more cost effective. I know that's something with Fresno State, and we have our clinic, Fresno Family Counseling Center, where we're seeing a lot of people who they're not getting access to the health care They're struggling with county. They're struggling to find resources and
well, they really don't make it easy. I mean, there's not like a process you can go through. Everything is so fragmented. So so for a person in crisis trying to deal with that.
Yeah, and so we try to provide the resources and referrals, and of course the counseling. Probably one of the biggest issues we see is the lack of psychiatric care, the access to the medications and the things, particularly for children. That's in our area that we certainly are in greater need of.
And Mr. Gibb, you were talking about the mental health first aid. Does that give people a way to maybe try to get involved? Because as we mentioned, people might see a person that they know and their behavior change. But an awful lot of times we hear after the fact that people will say, well, I noticed something, but they didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, is this something where you're advocating that people in a way get involved?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, mental health first aid, the concept is very much like regular first aid. It trains people, you know, not how to diagnose or treat mental illness. You know, that's what clinicians do. And you know, folks like Professor Weir are very effective at that. What our goal is to kind of on the front lines, whatever those front lines may be, whether it's the classroom, you know, a registration desk at a clinic, or even somebody working in the community, maybe in a faith-based organization, to give them some training on what they might be seeing, what kind of some of those initial signs and symptoms look like, and then walk through some scenarios on how to reach out to somebody, how to talk to somebody about what you observe in a positive and supportive way, and then how to, if appropriate, refer that person to services or suggest self-care for that person. The work that NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, does, that Mary Lou is involved in, is also really important because stigma or a negative concept of mental illness is oftentimes a barrier for people seeking treatment. Maybe they know that something's up with their kid, but you know what? They just, you know, they don't want their kid labeled as quote-unquote one of those people, unquote, when in fact their child may, you know, go to see Professor Weir and have a real positive outcome. By some early intervention.
You know, that's one of the things that you mentioned in bringing this up when it talks about how mental illness might affect a family or a parent. One of the things that kind of struck me, I don't know if any of the rest of you have read this article or seen the blog called I Am Adam Lanza's Mother.
Yes.
And it was a mom's perspective on mental illness. And she talked about her own situation and struggling with a 13-year-old mentally ill son and what she had to go through. And the fact that she was actually, she said she was terrified of him and that he had threatened her. And when they would go to the hospital, there would be, you know, no room for him to stay overnight or whatever was needed. And so and she was told by law enforement that her put him in jail.
Yeah.
I mean, you have parents who really struggle with this.
Exactly. Those are the challenges that families face when they have a child or children with various kinds of mental illness. I do want to be clear that what that mother, Ms. Long, was talking about was a different diagnosis than what we know thus far about Adam Lanza. I mean, you know, the autism spectrum is not typically violent.
But one of the things...
But she was talking about oppositional defiant disorder, which as you look at a continuum of that to conduct disorder to antisocial personality, that's where we start to see more violence, and that's different. We don't know what Mr. Lanza was...
No, at this point, we really don't know what all he may have been struggling with. Mary Lou, I wanted to bring you in on this, too, where you talk about, you know, the family, and how does this impact a family and
I think it's been mentioned that one of the big barriers to getting help is, first of all, stigma around mental illness. People, that holds people back from seeking help because of the stigma. They feel that they'll be somehow branded, that this is they caused it. Mental illnesses are brain illnesses. We know that now, especially with the kind of technology that can view the brain and see how the brain malfunctions just like any other body organ, and mental illnesses are complex. On a whole spectrum of mental illnesses, brain illnesses include a lot of different things, the things that could be anxiety, depression, schizophrenia, bipolar. Autism is a brain disorder. It isn't functioning in a normal way. And so for families, when they have a child that's whose behavior changes or is out of the normal range of what you would expect, they need to seek help. They need to find a professional. However, in this valley, we do not have any inpatient beds for children and youth. If a family has a child up to the age through 17 who has a mental illness, needs inpatient care, they have to go to the Bay Area, Sacramento, Ventura, and down south in California. And there is nothing local. We really can't say that about the other kinds of illnesses that children have that need hospitalization. Usually any other illness can be treated locally, at least for a period of time. We do not have that in Fresno.
To kind of wrap up this portion of our conversation, I'd like for you each to kind of, if you can address, you know, what steps do we need to take in this country and as a society to really address and to provide services for the mentally ill? Start with you, Professor Ware.
Well, we need to look at it from both a resource issue as well as a family education. I would say that we need to develop the resources so that, as was mentioned, that we could have a local facility for inpatient care. But we also have to educate families. You know, counseling is confidential. And so this idea of stigma, nobody really has to know, because there's the confidentiality factor that you can come, you can get help, and we're very effective in treating that. In terms of what our country needs to do, we need to understand mental illness from an educational perspective, devote the resources that we need to do, help identify early on intervention, prevention types of models.
Mr. Gibb?
Thank you. I would say that, first off, to recognize that mental illness is not them, it's us. One in four Americans will experience a mental illness in any given year. Anxiety disorders, depression, psychosis, substance use disorders are common. And, you know, like Mary Lou said, it's a brain disease like any other, and really try to reduce the stigma around that. And again, education around mental illness to give people some practical ways that they can respond to individuals at the early stages of their illness or in the late stages of their illness. Really encourage your listeners to take a look at we have 75 instructors within 50 miles of Fresno and all the surrounding counties. The Central Valley of California has been a real early adopter of our program, and has really it's really blossomed. So encourage you to go to mentalhealthfirstaid.org, put in your zip code, and see the resources that you have there for mental health first aid. We have instructors at NAMI right there in the valley, as well as in Fresno County. So check out ways that you can learn how, as a citizen, to take care of not only your loved ones, but also your community.
Thank you for that resource. We appreciate it. And Mary Lou, we'll let you wrap it up.
Okay. NAMI Fresno has a number of free services that we provide for families and for the community. I'd say number one is educating the public about mental illness, educating school personnel. We have a program specifically for staff in service. We have courses, classes that last 10, 12 weeks for families to understand mental illness, signs and symptoms, and treatment for adults with mental illness in your family or even children. And becoming educated about it is, I think, the most important thing for the public and for families and for schools, so that those who are showing early signs can at least get the help that they need. Early intervention saves so much, saves from having the illness get worse. It saves from having tragedies, and it saves from having children drop out of school. 40% of adults who have a severe mental illness did show signs by the time they were 13. And we need to be aware, and we need to pay attention.
Thank you all. Mary Lou Browder-Minkler with the National Alliance on Mental Illness Fresno. Brian Gibb, Director of Public Education, National Council for Community Behavioral Health Care. And Professor Kyle Ware, Associate Professor of Marriage and Family Therapy at Fresno State. Thank you all.
Thank you for
joining us in this conversation. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley
Thank
Edition.
You.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. We are going to continue our discussion coming out of the mass murders in Newtown, Connecticut. Now, this is one of those issues that is so controversial and it elicits such strong feelings on both sides that it's been difficult for the country to kind of come together to discuss it, and that is gun control. Here are some of the facts about guns in America. According to the CDC, more than 30,000 gun-related deaths in the United States every year that happens. 89 guns for every 60 Americans compared to 6 in England and Wales. 31 school shootings since Columbine in 1999. 13 people were killed there. Joining us for this discussion is Josh Horowitz, Executive Director, Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. And joining us later will be Barry Bauer with, he's the president of Herb Bauer Sporting Goods. Let's start with Mr. Horowitz in the conversation. You know, after something like this, we go back and we have these discussions about gun control. Not much has happened over the last few years. Now, Senator Feinstein and others are calling for the federal assault weapons ban, which expired in 2004, to be reinstated. What kind of effect do you think? Did that law have any effect on reducing violent crime? Did it work?
First of all, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate being here. So the evidence on that is that there were fewer mass shootings than there are today. That's a correlation. But I think when you see the power of these types of weapons, the ability to kill people so fast, the extended magazines, I think that the evidence points that this did make a difference, and the reality of Newtown brings it home. So I don't think anybody I'm hopeful that we will come to a consensus in this country that these type of weapons are not appropriate on the streets.
And so are you saying after this latest incident, do you think there will be some kind of action? Or will we hear a lot of talk and then it kind of goes away?
Well, we've seen some pretty amazing things the last days, and I think the biggest indication that this is going to be different is when you have people like Mark Warner, my senator here in Virginia, who's always voted with the NRA, and Joe Manchin, who's a very staunch gun rights Democrat in West Virginia, coming out and saying it's time to get rid of assault weapons. I thought Manchin said it best. He said, I was just hunting last week, and no one in my party, and I've never hunted more than two or three rounds in the firearm. I can't understand why anybody would need 30-round magazines, multiple 30-round magazines.
Unfortunately, Mr. Horowitz, we do have a very bad phone line with you. We're having difficulty hearing you. I'm going to try to ask you one more question and see how that goes, and we might have to try again. When we talk about assault weapons, what exactly does that mean? One of the guns reportedly used in this incident was a AR-15-style gun. But, you have a lot of weapons that are semi-automatic pistols, traditional rifles. So what are we talking about when we say assault weapons?
An assault weapon has a number of features, but the two that make it particularly deadly are the ability to accept detachable high-capacity magazines and the pistol grip, as well as a something forward-mounted like a barrel shroud that allows you to keep the barrel on your target. That's why it's designed for war. It doesn't have what they call creep as other weapons do. This is a weapon that's designed to fire lots of rounds into one target without being, you know, and keep focused on that target. And that's why you saw such deathly destruction here in New York. And those are the types of weapons that should be prohibited. California, of course, has prohibited them for years.
Okay, we're going to try to see if we can get a better line with you, Mr. Horowitz, because right now we're really breaking up badly. So we do have Barry Bauer, President Herb Bauer Sporting Goods here. And talking about, as you heard him mention, a lot of people talk about, is there really a need for the average gun enthusiast to have an assault weapon?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me today. The industry doesn't call them assault weapons. The industry calls them modern sporting rifles. There are more of these types of guns with characteristics of semi-automatic in America than any other firearm in America, okay? They're very, very, very popular and in the semi-automatic form. We're talking millions of modern sporting rifles, which is what the previous interviewer was talking about. These are we have a law in California that limits a couple of the characteristics of modern sporting rifles, but we sell all of these, what he's calling assault rifles, right now and have always in California. There's a few characteristics that are undesirable in these guns, but they can be made up in a lot of different configurations.
You know, the mother of the shooter in Newtown, she was a gun enthusiast. She mm-hmm. she had a number of guns in the home. She went to the shooting range, and she from some of the reports I've heard, she even took her son. How has this tragedy affected the firearms community in a situation like this, where you have someone who's a gun enthusiast, but they have someone in the home who was apparently mentally ill and got their hands on that gun?
Well, that seems to be a characteristic of a number of these mass shootings. This individual was underage at age 20, so he couldn't buy any of the semi-automatic handguns. He did take the guns from his mother after shooting her. Other incidents around the country, many of them, the individuals haven't been able to purchase a gun, didn't buy the gun, borrowed the gun or stole it from a friend and created these atrocities. I think the whole core of the thing is around the mental illness aspect of this thing, because we have checks and balances as gun dealers, federal forms requirements and background checks that keep the good guys getting guns and the bad guys that have records, that have mental illness in their history and so forth, they're not able to purchase them. All of these events are random events that everything about them is illegal already.
But, you know, in some of the cases, from what I have read going back, some of these people purchased the guns legally.
Right. But when we learn after the fact that they've had mental illness in their background.
Right, but they may have had the mental illness. We learn later that they do, but they were still able to
which
get
brings,
a gun.
Which brings me to the problem. I don't think our mental health community in America, the mental health system, is properly reporting individuals to the system that are mentally ill. There's a designation that police have of 5150. Those are people that they consider are somewhat mentally unstable. And those things are reported into the police files. Maybe we need something kind of like that for doctors and insist that they report them to the central file so that we can avoid us dealers, after doing the background checks, from delivering a gun to somebody that is mentally unstable.
Can you describe what a current background check process at this point is?
Well, in the state of California handles it for all the gun dealers in California, and it takes if we fill out paperwork and the computer application into Sacramento costs $25, and they check the judicial records to find out if the person is a bad guy from a felon point of view. They check to see if he's had restraining orders on them. They check to see if he's been involved in domestic violence. All of these are separate databases in California, as well as the mental databases, okay? And they determine within a 10-day period of time if this person is eligible to pick his gun up in 10 days from my store. Some states have instant background checks run by the FBI on the national level, and they're supposed to be checking all the things that I just talked about because I have a copy of the federal form here, and each one of these questions that are asked are supposed to be being checked on a national database also.
You know, after – and it was reported that after President Obama was elected, you had the gun sales shot up after he was reelected. They shot up again. Because apparently, I assume people think there will be tougher gun laws. How many do you have an indication of how many more guns were sold during that time? I think I've heard an increase of I can't remember 20% or more or something like that.
The national averages on gun registrations are the telling factor here, and over the course of the last 3-4 years. They've been going up at a compounded rate of over 20% increases per year. In other words, a lot of people are concerned for a lot of reasons. Some are concerned about the state of the economy and its degeneration and want to be able to secure the safety of their families. Others think that the president administration might take their firearms away, you know, ban them or something like that. And we've got 280 million guns in America. That just isn't going to happen. So we've got to learn, and it's in the Constitution.
That's an awful lot of guns, and I think that's what concerns people. We are such a armed nation.
Yeah, but look at the small, while horrific, small number of incidents that are occurring. Horrific incidences, I might add. Small number of them, considering we've got 280 million guns out there with responsible citizens. It's amazing that we have that low a percentage.
Well, I think that might be hard for some of the families who've had to suffer through one of these tragedies.
Oh, it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible.
Do you think, when you look at the situation now, that there will be some sort of gun control? Because right now, basically, if people want a gun, they can get a gun. I mean, people's rights aren't being diminished in any kind of way.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, anybody can get anything they want in America. I mean, drugs are illegal, but people get drugs. Guns are illegal for some people, felons and so forth, but they can get guns. Gang members can get guns. It's all on how much you want to pay and where the black market is. So more gun laws for us, good citizens, if you want to look at it that way, are not necessary because, as Sheriff Mims pointed out earlier, the gun people are the gun people. She can always count on her carry concealed weapons people to do the right thing. She's never had an incident. However, the bad people are the problem, and we've got all the laws we need to put those people away because they kill people, they steal the guns before they kill the people, and so on and so forth. So between mental health and law enforcement, we've got enough laws.
Mr. Bauer, thank you very much for your time. I'm going to bring back in Mr. Horowitz. We have to cut him short on time because we had a phone problem. Josh Horowitz, I do have a couple of more questions for you to try to give you the same amount of time. And I don't know if you've been listening, but your thoughts on whether or not you think, when you think about the number of guns we have in this society.
I was listening to the conversation fascinated because, of course, in California, you guys, in California where you are, you have a really great system, and I wish we could extend that to the rest of the country. And I was fascinated by Mr. Bauer's comments that he thought that system worked fine, especially the he mentioned this code 5150, where you are able to put people who are dangerously mentally ill because of a danger to themselves or others into the system. We don't have that in the rest of the country. And one of the things I'm fascinated to hear him say is that he thinks that's a good idea. We agree on that. I think that the 5150 could be a model for the rest of the country, and it's nice to find some areas of agreement with members, from the gun lobby, if you will, because I think that we do need to do a better and more, I say, a more a better check on mental health workers. We do a very broad one now, but it's not very effective. 5150 in California seems to be much more effective. So I was really glad to hear that. And if we could get the same regime that you guys have in California, which Mr. Barrett seems not to think is a problem, I think we'd solve a lot of problems, because California has dropped their gun death rate dramatically over the last 10 years.
Well, a lot of Californians would be happy, you know, to hear that. But what you're saying is, you know, everything isn't about a ban on weapons. There are other things we can do to keep guns out of the hands of people who should not have them.
Right. And it's clear. And we also, you know, we can't ban handguns. I mean, there's a Supreme Court decision that says people have a right to have a handgun in their home. So we have to do other things. And part of that is to make sure, A, that all the records are in the mental health system, in the National Instant Text system, which is something that California does very well right now, and B, make sure the people who are the most risk of danger are in the system. So people who are, you know, who have been determined by a mental health professional to be a danger to themselves or others, of course, comes to that category. But there's other categories, like violent misdemeanors. There's a number of studies that show if you've been convicted of a violent misdemeanor, you're more likely to commit another one, and you're more likely to become a gun criminal. So there are ways to improve the system, but the number one thing is to put the records we have in the system. And right now, only 13 states are fully reporting their mental health records into the National Instant Check system anyway.
I think people would really be surprised to know that. I think because we have that situation here in California, we think it's across the rest of the country, and it's not.
It's not. And California, in many ways, is a model, and we are really, you know, we've been so pleased to see the violent crime rate drop in the gun death rate drop in California, and that's really exciting.
Well, I'd like to thank you both, Mr. Horowitz and Barry Bauer, President Herb Bauer Sporting Goods, for taking the time to discuss such a controversial issue. And I'm sure people, the public, are hoping that something good can come from all of this, and we can move forward in a comprehensive way. That is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear our audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weber, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.